And welcome into the Minnesota Progressive Repartee for your Wednesday afternoon. Brett Johnson joining you, and today's show is pre-recorded as a heads up, but we do have some great interviews lined up. Coming up, we'll be speaking with Aaron Clems from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy about the latest on PolyMet. Some of the news that's been coming up recently with PolyMet really is going to make your head spin. Then we'll also be joined by Peter Callahan of MinPost talking about two subjects, one, the latest on the insulin bill, and then also the history of the DFL party, as he recently wrote an extensive piece about where we got the FL in DFL. But before we get into those, do want to bring up some headlines from today. The federal court just said states can set their own net neutrality rules, and that could really impact us here in Minnesota, because during the last legislative session, the DFL-controlled House actually did pass net neutrality regulations. Unfortunately, as you might have predicted, though, it got held up in the Senate, of course, controlled by Republicans, so very important that we elect a DFL-controlled Senate in 2020 so we can get net neutrality here in Minnesota, because again, a federal court just said that can now be left up to the states instead of the federal government. And one more note, our Democratic debate watching party coming up Tuesday, October 15th at Burger Mo's. Hope to see you there. We should have tickets available soon on am950radio.com. All right, coming up next, our interview with Aaron Clems of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy as we talk about the latest in PolyMet and other environmental news. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We're joined now by Aaron Clems. He's the Director of Public Engagement for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, as we're going to talk about the latest in environmental news here in Minnesota and the entire Midwest, because there is certainly lots to cover. Hey, Aaron, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Brett. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to start off with what's been happening with Xcel Energy, because they recently were denied trying to buy a gas plant in Mankato, as Xcel Energy asked state regulators if the company could buy a natural gas plant in Mankato for about $650 million, and they pitched it as a way to help speed up the demise of coal and bring some environmental benefits to the state. Xcel even convinced several influential clean energy nonprofits to support the idea, including you guys over at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, but the PUC unanimously turned down Xcel's request to buy the plant, saying it was a risk for Xcel customers that could lead to higher energy bills with minimal benefits. So, Aaron, let's talk a little bit about this, because I normally wouldn't think of groups like you guys, of course, the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, kind of being in the same boat as Xcel Energy, but this was the case here, and I'm sure you guys think it's probably unfortunate that this plant will not be bought by Xcel.
Yeah, and what we know now is that Xcel will not purchase the plant directly, but they will just purchase it through an affiliate. And so in the end, Xcel still ends up owning the plant. The difference is, for us, is that the Public Utilities Commission, which regulates the natural gas plant, if Xcel buys it, will not have the same level of regulatory oversight, and the people of Minnesota will not have the same say in how that gas plant gets regulated when it's owned by an affiliate. That's complicated. Let me break it down a little bit. I mean, ultimately, because Xcel is a monopoly, right, they're a utility that controls a territory, and they're the only option for folks in that territory, the state has regulatory authority, really strong regulatory authority over it, and to protect taxpayers and ratepayers, but also to protect the environment as one of the things that they're required to do under state law. By not having that gas plant owned by Xcel, but rather owned by another company, and they just buy the power, there's not the same level of regulatory oversight. The reason why this is important is because Xcel has committed to 80% reductions of greenhouse gas emissions by 2030 and 100% by 2050, which we think is a really strong goal. But they have to get there as soon as we possibly can, and the first thing we have to do is get rid of coal. And so as part of the plan to purchase the plant, they agreed to retire their last two coal plants in Minnesota by 2028 and 2030, which was a huge victory for the environment, and now that's been thrown into question by the PUC's decision. The last thing that Xcel committed to do was that they were going to build 3,000 megawatts of solar by 2030 as well as part of this plan. We think a lot of parts of this plan will still go into effect, but we're worried about the execution of them, and we think it's been complicated by the PUC's decision on Friday.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the PUC's reasons for turning down this idea of Xcel directly buying this plant. Among other things, the Commerce Department said Xcel did not test renewable energy as a replacement option for the gas plant as required by law. What do you think about some of these arguments that were made against Xcel getting this plant, including the idea that it could actually increase the rates for some customers?
Well, I think, you know, there's going to be some transition costs as we move away from our coal-heavy system. And it's true that wind and solar are definitely cheaper options in the long run, but we also need to find some way of getting there. The tricky part with this natural gas plant that I think folks need to recognize is that it already exists and it's already feeding Xcel's power system. They're already buying this power. However, Xcel has also proposed to build a new natural gas power plant at Becker to replace the coal plants that they're retiring there. We're not really convinced that's a good idea. In fact, we think it's a pretty bad idea to build new natural gas fossil fuel plant infrastructure. It would be a real shame for us to tell Xcel not to buy the plant that they're already buying the power from and then have Xcel move on to build brand new fossil fuel infrastructure because of that. And so we think that needs to be taken into account as you think about this decision. Certainly, we believe that wind and solar are the future. We need to get to 100% renewable clean energy as soon as we possibly can. We were supportive in this case because we thought that this was the way to get there faster.
Right, exactly. And you guys are kind of thinking this is a nice transition to something even cleaner because, well, at least natural gas is, of course, better and for the environment than coal.
Yeah, no. I mean, in the end, is it better than coal? I mean, we have to get off of fossil fuels to save the climate. I mean, there's no doubt about that. We do know that in order for us to make this transition, the dirtiest coal plants need to shut down as soon as possible. You know, and the idea that we had gotten an agreement to close down all but one of Minnesota's coal burning power plants by 2030 was something we were really happy and excited about. We're hopeful that we can still achieve that outcome with Xcel, despite the fact that the PUC turned down this proposal to buy the Mankato plant.
Let's move on to another issue, and this has to do with Twin Metals, because recently they made an announcement, I believe it was over the summer, that they are going to be switching to what's called a dry stack method of waste rock storage, which is something it seemed like in theory you guys were in support of. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because we'll also get into the fact that they've been citing you guys a lot in some of their reports where it's kind of been misleading, saying that, oh, you guys support Twin Metals when that's not exactly the case. But before we get there, tell us a little bit, what is the dry stack method, and is this a better method that Twin Metals could be potentially using?
Well, so first of all, Twin Metals has not even proposed a mine yet, and they are issuing press releases that say that they will do things that they haven't demonstrated that they even can achieve yet. And so when we get a press release from a mining company, we don't just take it with a grain of salt. We take it with heaps and heaps of salt. And so that's the first thing folks should know is there's not any defined plan yet. This is a press release from a company that wants to mine right up to the edge of the boundary waters, and they should be very suspicious of that. But dry stack tailings disposal is something that has become considered to be best available technology for keeping mine waste from bursting dams like it has in Brazil recently, killing 300 people at the Brumadinho Dam in Brazil, or at the Mount Polley disaster in British Columbia in 2014. In dry stack disposal, rather than mixing mine waste with water, you drain it of water and then store it in as dry a state as you can, and then try to collect polluted water and cap it off so that there's not more water in that stack of mine waste. The alternative to that right now is storing it wet, mixed with mine waste, behind the dam. And at the Polymet mine site, just 15 miles south of where Twin Metals proposes to build their mine, this is what they propose to do with their waste, and we're very concerned about that. So while dry stacking is an incremental improvement, you can't use best available technology to make a mine that's inherently going to pollute a precious resource like the boundary waters safe. In the end, this is just a better or worse way to store a lot of polluting material, and parking a bunch of polluted material right next to the boundary waters is a bad idea, no matter how it's stored.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's kind of the lesser of two evils. And, of course, building the mine potentially in the first place, not a good idea when you could potentially, harm the boundary waters, a huge resource here in Minnesota, not only for, of course, being great for the environment, but also a big tourist destination as well. So definitely kind of see where you guys are coming from on that one.
One more thing I want to say to be really clear, though, is that the Lake Superior watershed is just as precious. I mean, people care just as much about what is downstream of the Polymet mine and the risk that a dam there poses. And so while we are certainly wanting to protect the Boundary Waters watershed, we also recognize the need to protect the Lake Superior watershed at the same time. And so it's one of those things where, you know, we're talking about an area of the state which is the top of two very precious and important watersheds. And even though they're only separated by 15 miles, these two copper nickel mine proposals threaten two of the most precious resources that Minnesotans care about.
Yeah, right, and something we certainly won't get back, at least for a very long time, if at all, if they do end up getting polluted. All right, so let's move on to Polymet, because there's been lots of news recently with them. In fact, the Minnesota Court of Appeals recently suspended more permits, I believe, including a mining one for Polymet's proposed $1 billion copper nickel mine, pending a court hearing next month. And one of the big problems I hear, Aaron, as I read through what's been happening, is that Glencore, of course, the parent company of Polymet, was not included on these permits, correct?
That's right. There's two issues that the court raised in suspending these permits, and then they've asked the DNR to respond to them at this October 23rd hearing, which is the next court hearing in this case. One is the collapse of the dam in Brazil that killed nearly 300 people that has direct connections to Polymet's dam design and also one of the engineers that is responsible for designing it. The second issue is the fact that Glencore is now the majority owner of the mine, but they're not listed on any of the permits. And these two issues are ones that occurred after the issuance of the permit. And so this is something that happened on the watch of Governor Walz and his Department of Natural Resources, and they so far have not responded with full analysis and full review of either of these two issues. So the court told them these permits are suspended and you need to come in front of the court on October 23rd and explain whether or not you've done a full review of these two issues.
And talking about this Glencore issue, if their name ultimately is not included on the permit, that, of course, could lead to some potential problems, let's say, if the mine goes wrong, because Polymet, as I understand it, could probably say, oh, we're out of business, nothing you can do for us, or nothing we can do for you if we end up polluting or having some sort of spill, where if you at least get Glencore's name on there, you can at least hold someone responsible should something go wrong if the mine is ultimately built, correct?
That's right. You know, so Polymet is a company that has no other asset other than that mine site. And if that mine site's not an asset but a cost, then there's nothing to get money from. There's a provision in Minnesota law called financial assurance that allows you to collect money and financial instruments to deal with the planned closure costs if a mine goes bankrupt. What those financial assurance regulations don't account for, though, is any change from the planned closure. So if we learn, for example, that there is pollution escaping the site that we didn't anticipate, there's no money for that. If there's a, God forbid, there's a dam that breaks and releases mine waste out onto the Embarrass River and into the St. Louis River, the cost of cleaning that up could be in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and that would never fully capture it. None of that would be covered by financial assurance. And right now, the only thing that we have to protect us from that is a $10 million liability insurance policy. Without Glencore being on the permit, there's no corporate parent with assets to go after in that case. So while we need to be really concerned about the environmental impact, the bottom line is you get better and more responsible corporate conduct if you actually have something at stake. If they can get up and walk away after they leave a mess, there's no reason for them to worry about leaving a mess. And so it's really critical that Glencore be added to the permit.
And by the way, got to add this in here. I won't name names, but it is nice to finally see the local corporate media here in town finally covering and talking about who exactly Glencore is, because we've known about them for a while, that they've been affiliated with Polymet. And, well, for a while, a lot of people didn't. So it's finally nice to actually see them getting some coverage to draw the connections between Glencore's very spotty environmental record, among other things. I know they also have some labor violations and them finally being connected to Polymet.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think that people don't understand that this is a company that the United Steelworkers have called the worst company in the world, and they ran a campaign in 2015 to try to get them named as such. This is the same company that owns many of the mines in parts of Africa and other parts of the developing world that folks like to cite as examples of why we should do it here instead. You know, so why are we trusting the very company that is engaged in these practices that we criticize in other parts of the world with our water here in Minnesota? We don't understand why that's true.
Fortunately, that's not the only news we have for PolyMet, as also recently the State Court of Appeal suspended PolyMet's water quality permit pending a Ramsey County District Court hearing into alleged irregularities in how the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency handled the permit. And this is kind of a complicated issue because I've been reading this through, Aaron, where it sounds like they didn't exactly have the most thorough conduct with the EPA in terms of their review of what's been happening with PolyMet. Can you talk a little bit about this and what these irregularities are?
Sure. So the Environmental Protection Agency is responsible for the permits that are issued by Minnesota's regulators, in this case the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It's a federal law, the Clean Water Act, and what's happened is they've delegated their authority under this act to the MPCA, but the EPA is responsible for overseeing that. And throughout the PolyMet review process, both for their environmental review and permitting, the EPA has been deeply and directly involved in the process, all the way up to the very end. Suddenly, what we find is in the spring of 2018, the EPA, which had been deeply and intimately involved in this process, reviewing it at every step of the way, suddenly goes silent. They don't issue any permits, any comments on the draft permit for the water permit that was issued. And we find out now that the reason why was because there was pressure put on them by the EPA Administrator, Kathy Stepp, who was appointed by the Trump administration, and by the MPCA Commissioner, to not issue comments during the public comment period, but rather to read them over the phone to folks after the comment period ended. And by doing that, none of those comments that the EPA staff had, they had many concerns, dozens of concerns, about the lack of enforceability of that permit. None of them made it into the public record. And it wasn't until later, when we discovered evidence of these irregularities, we were able to use the tools of the Freedom of Information Act and the Data Practices Act to uncover a lot of these documents that have been hidden from us. That's why it's such an important thing, is because the EPA, all the way up to 2 days before the permit was issued, is telling the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency that there's real concerns about whether this permit is enforceable. So, you know, we know a lot more now than we did a few months ago, and the court has ordered that this be referred back to a district court proceeding where they can investigate and further find out if there are more documents that relate to this. So we are just in the process of waiting for the district court to do their investigation. Separately, there are two other investigations, one at the federal level, one at the state level, looking into the same set of facts. And so there's a lot more information to come on this case, we fear.
That whole idea just makes my head spin because, as you brought up, I mean, these are only the documents that you guys have uncovered that we know about in the public because, well, when there's smoke, there's probably fire. So I'm guessing there's probably, well, other very important documents that haven't been uncovered or other conversations about concerns with PolyMet that we don't even know about yet.
Well, yeah, and there might be documents, but there also might be conversations that happen where critical decisions were made by phone or in person that are not recorded anywhere. Right. So one of the things that's the hallmark of this case that I think it's important for folks to keep in mind is there was a, you know, having folks read these comments over the phone and then losing the notes from that phone call, which is something we know happened now because of these court proceedings. Three separate MPCA employees who listened in on this phone call where they read these notes over the phone, all either destroyed or did not take their notes for a variety of reasons. There's a reason why they're doing it that way, is to avoid public scrutiny of their decision-making process, and the public can't stand for that. I mean, no matter what the decision is, especially when it's as important as this one, where literally hundreds of years of water pollution are at stake, we cannot be making decisions in the dark and not knowing how our regulators are protecting us or not. And that's what we're finding out through this case right now, and it's very concerning to us.
And there's essentially no recourse if, as you said, no one took notes, or if they happen to forget to take notes, using forget in quotes, or destroyed them, or, yeah, there's really no recourse in terms of, finding out what actually happened in these conversations without, well, I guess someone coming forward and saying what did happen, correct?
Right. You know, so to the point about what happened on this phone call, so you have the, here's what we know so far, like there's email saying, you know, you can't, please read these notes over the phone and do it with our staff after the comment period is over. Then three employees from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency all filed separate declarations with the court where they said, one said, well, I write these notes down for my own memory purposes, but they're in my own unique shorthand, and so they are not of any use to anybody else, so I destroyed them after the call. Another person said, well, the person on the other end of the line was talking very quickly, and so I just got frustrated that I couldn't take notes fast enough, so I stopped taking notes. I didn't have any notes from the call. And the third person said, a lot of these notes that I took were in my capacity as an attorney working for them, so they're not eligible to be. So I just kept them in my own file and then eventually destroyed them. These are the facts that were recounted by the MPCA employees under oath to the court. Right. So there's a lot of questions that we have about the practice here, and certainly there are things that have been done that are that have had the effect of shrouding from the public what the actual process was to make these decisions. And that's just wrong. You know, Minnesotans should know why we made the decisions we did and how. And by doing it this way, they've prevented people from knowing the full truth.
Wow, unbelievable. We've been speaking with Aaron Klems. He's the Director of Public Engagement for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Certainly a story we have to continue to follow. And Aaron, tell us where people can keep up with your guys' work over at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, how they can follow along with these issues, because it's very important that these things stay in the news and people are aware, because, wow, definitely some rotten things happening with PolyMet right now.
Yeah, so I think, you know, first of all, our website is mncenter.org, and please go there and check out what we got there. We keep our website updated with the latest information, but also on social media, we're on Facebook and Twitter at MCEA1974, MCEA1974, and that is where you can get the most up-to-the-minute updates from our work here in the state of Minnesota to defend our environment and people that depend on it.
That's Aaron Klems from the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us on the program today and talking about these very important issues.
Thank you so much, Brett. I appreciate it.
And coming up next on the program, we're going to be taking a deep dive look at the insulin controversy. Will we eventually see a special session that will finally lead to emergency insulin funding? We'll be speaking with Peter Callahan of MinnPost up next about that and more. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We're joined now by Peter Callahan. He covers state government for MinnPost. And recently, he's been writing about the insulin fight between both the DFL and the GOP trying to get emergency insulin funding. Peter joins us now on the program to tell us about that fight. Peter, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate you taking some time to go through what's been happening in this dispute between the GOP and the DFL. So let's go back in time a little bit, back to when we actually had the legislative session, and it looked like we were going to get that emergency insulin funding bill until it kind of died in the Senate. So as you've talked to both DFLers and Republicans, what are both sides saying actually happened with emergency insulin funding falling through at the very last minute?
Well, you know, we like a nice, clean fight when one side is on one side and the other is on the other. This one went back and forth in so many odd ways that it's hard to track completely. The House DFL were originating this idea that there'd be some sort of system based on the tragic death of Alex Smith, who was a diabetic who aged off of his parents' insurance and was trying to stretch out his insulin supply to his next payday, and died of a complication called ketoacidosis. And that is the origin of the Alex Smith Emergency Insulin Act. And the DFL was pushing it. They were going to put a fee of some sort on the insulin manufacturers to raise in state government a relatively small amount of money, $2 million, maybe $3 million. And the Republicans were opposed to it. And they were opposed to it throughout the session, said there's other ways to do it, or it should be general fund, or it should be some other source of money. And then one night late in session on the Senate floor on their omnibus bill, suddenly they're moving, debating, and passing unanimously language that almost mimics the House DFL plan. And the advocates were shocked. They didn't expect it. The legislators in the House were monitoring it because they were on the floor at the same time. It was just major breakthrough and victory. Then that bill is part of the conference committee report, and when the conference committee report comes out, you know, after all night, late night sessions, it's not there. And then the finger pointing begins. The Senate Republicans said, well, you didn't bring it to the table. The House DFL says, no, no, you specifically said you were taking it out. So it was gone. So then they've been arguing about how to fund it. Should it be the industry directly? Should it be some other source of money? The Senate Republicans had agreed to extend the health care provider tax, which is something they didn't want to do, raises hundreds of millions of dollars. Why not take a few out of that? So that's where it was until the Senate then came up with their plan, which in fact now draws on the industry to not through a fee, but to essentially provide free insulin to people who were qualified under this program. So it's gone back and forth on the funding, and so it's hard to be clean as to who's providing and who's supporting what. Meanwhile, the advocates are waiting for this program to come in and are, understandably frustrated.
What do you think changed, especially on the Republican side, to really come back to the negotiating table? Because for a while, it looked like we weren't going to see any sort of bill, probably until the next session. Was it something about maybe having some potentially vulnerable GOP suburban senators in the next election? What overall do you think changed for them to come back with their own proposal and possibly an agreement with the DFL coming up in a special session?
Right. Well, throughout the summer, there were Republicans in the Senate, what I guess passes these days for a more moderate Republican, although neither are especially moderate, certainly not liberal. Jim Abler and Scott Jensen were meeting with DFLers to try to come up with some ideas, and actually, according to the DFL sponsors, helped perfect the bill. They were still disagreeing over funding, however, and that didn't close the deal. It's interesting. Big Pharma has become such a political albatross, I guess, that neither side wants to be labeled as helping Big Pharma. And the Republicans saw the political optics of what this looked like, even though they said, well, we passed these other things that would help people get insulin if their prescription had expired, or if, we're going to set up a website that helps people find out where free and assisted insulin supplies can come from. That wasn't enough, and the optics were such that I think they felt politically they had to get off that side of the issue and come in and actually try to solve the problem.
And you were talking about this relationship that, well, politicians have with Big Pharma and how, of course, in recent years it's gotten very, very toxic in terms of public opinion. So especially on the Republican side, they've been trying to do a very delicate balancing act in terms of trying to make sure that, of course, they don't, well, for lack of a better way of putting it, annoy the pharmaceutical industry versus also trying to help their reelection chances and also just trying to help people find insulin as well. But it sounds like so far they've kind of gotten mixed reaction from the pharmaceutical industry on this bill from Senator Pratt in terms of what the reaction has been, because it sounds like he says, the industry says they support this bill, but then we're actually getting some lobbying groups. I think the one you cited was Pharma, or I'm not actually sure how to say that name, but they're actually saying, no, they don't support Pratt's bill. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's a hard one to completely decipher. I think he says that he has had conversations with representatives from Pharma, which is the lobbying, national and state lobbying organization for the brand name drug makers. And they issued a statement saying they really don't think they should be paying for this. However, the fact that they have avoided, at least if this goes through, a specific fee or tax, which they really hate. They hated it on the opioids bill. They hate it on this bill. Instead, sort of piggybacking and expanding on what they already do, which is to provide free drugs to people who can't afford them. So they're using the same mechanism. It looks like charity on their part. It looks like generosity on their part as opposed to paying a tax. But one of the advocates told the committee the other day that they have programs like that right now, and one out of four get some help from them, and three out of four people who ask for help do not. If this was to happen and to work, far more people would be getting free insulin from the companies than get it now. So they would definitely be expanding those programs. And it's almost like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Pratchett says he feels like he has assurance that they will not sue or resist or push back on it.
So as you've had conversations with people around the Capitol, whether it's politicians or lobbyists, is there a sense from the industry that they are going to have to compromise on something in terms of providing more insulin for people who are in need?
Well, both here and nationally, they're going to have to do something about just overall pricing. I mean, if they hadn't increased the price on this hormone, there's estimates say 1,200% in a decade or so. If the price wasn't as high as it was, then none of this other stuff would happen or need to happen. So they're still pushing from political people, both congressionally and in the state, to get the price of insulin reduced. There's some thought that insulin, because it's a hormone, it's not a drug, the non-brand name version is called a biosimilar, that so far there have not been biosimilars for insulin, and there's a hope that it could come onto the market soon and help with pricing, but even that is not a guarantee. When Sharon Benson was on the side of taxing the insulin makers back in May and had passed the bill in the Senate, she exempted a generic/biosimilar product because she did not want to discourage them from coming into Minnesota. She didn't want to have a fee, even if it's a fairly small fee. The real issue is the price. Mm-hmm. And all of this is just dealing with the consequences of these price increases. And it's not just on insulin. It's on many prescription drugs. And that's, I think, how pharma has lost at least the unquestioned support of some politicians, because they're hearing from the folks in their districts, maybe a lot of seniors/voters, who do not understand why those prices are going up that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go back to this GOP bill from Senator Eric Pratt. So it's kind of gotten maybe a lukewarm reception from DFLers saying it's a start, but part of the problem they're saying with the bill is that while it is a good start, it essentially means that if you are someone who's a type 1 diabetic, you actually have to plan to kind of be in an emergency, and they say that's, well, not realistic, because when you get in a financial emergency, that's usually not a planned thing in your life. Talk a little bit about that.
To say they're lukewarm, it's not all that they want, and we can talk about the emergency provision yet, but I think they're pretty excited that the GOP has crossed the barrier of having the industry foot some of the bill for this. That's a big deal, and they don't want to dismiss the significance of that, because that is, in fact, a big concession. Even the bill that the DFL had passed last session wasn't actually an emergency bill. You still had to make an application to the state to look at your finances and make a determination. That determination could take 2 days, 3 days, a week. So if you were in fact in an emergent situation, as Alex Smith was, 3 days was too long. So even they realized that their bill wasn't really an emergency bill. And it was, again, the work of this work group over the summer, the bipartisan work group, that they came up with what's now their latest version, which is you go to the pharmacist with your application. The pharmacist presumes that you are eligible, provides insulin to you at that moment, and then runs it through the system to be approved. That's the little step that is missing from the Pratt bill. Now, again, this gets us back into the who pays for it issue, because the DFL says we should still be putting a fee, perhaps a smaller fee, because it's a smaller population of patients, on the industry to pay for that little step, to reimburse the pharmacist who provided that insulin. The GOP is not there yet on that. They still don't want a fee on insulin manufacturers. They claim it would contribute to cost increases and increase costs of of health care, and you can argue that all you want, but that's where they are. So what would need to happen is DFLers would need to say, okay, for this little chunk of it, we're okay taking some money from, say, healthcare access fund. Mm-hmm. So even though it's at that one tiny piece, it takes us back to the debate over funding, and it's going to be harder than it seems to solve that last little chunk.
So from the DFL perspective, you're thinking they might in the short term at least say, all right, hey, GOP, we can at least take some funding from the Minnesota healthcare provider tax, at least in the short term here. Are you kind of getting the sense that we might be on our way to at least a short-term compromise with maybe a larger debate for long-term funding for emergency insulin?
Yeah, here's what Mike Howard, and Mike Howard is really the first person on this issue because Alec and Alec's parents, Nicole Holtzsmith, who's been just the face of this, and James Smith, they were in his district, and so those were constituents of him. So Mike Howard has been really the first legislator on these issues. And I asked him about that last little chunk last week, and he said, it doesn't make sense to be so rigid that we're not open to ideas. As long as the insulin manufacturers are the key responsible funding entity, I'm open to some level of other resources being included. And if the bulk of those supplies are coming through the manufacturers' own programs, the cost, and I could not get anybody to try to take a run at what the cost would be, but if the total cost before was $3 million and you're taking a big chunk of the supply out, meaning you can apply under this Pratt proposal for a 120-day supply and it can extend for up to a year, is it $200,000? Is it $350,000 that's left to pay for that actual day of the emergency program? The DFL would have to give away a lot of the concessions that the Pratt bill makes to require that be done by a fee. So I think the odds are that it does get done. The last we've heard is that they want what they call an unofficial conference committee of decision makers, which is a euphemism for, you know, the big wigs on healthcare and finance from the legislature to meet together, probably with someone from the Tim Walz administration to hammer out a bill that could be going on anytime now.
Yeah, as you wrote about, that's going to be Speaker Melissa Hortman, Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka, and as you said, probably representatives from the Walz administration. Do we have any idea on a timeline on that? Do they maybe have a goal of trying to get something done by the end of the year, or what are we looking at on that front?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think definitely by the end of the year. The session comes in again in early February. So, you know, you wait too long, it doesn't necessarily make sense to call a special session, but sessions get started very slowly, so the beauty of a special session, 1 or 2 days, is that it's focused on that one issue, and they all want to finish and get it done. So I think, boy, odds, a better chance than not that there's some sort of special session before the end of 2019.
And that's part one of our interview with Peter Callahan of MinnPost. Coming up on the other side of the break, it's part two as we talk about the other piece that Peter wrote in MinnPost, talking about the history of the DFL party. Where did that FL part come from in DFL? We'll talk more about that up next here on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. Welcome back to the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. We're now going to play back part two of our conversation with Peter Callahan of MinnPost, as we'll be talking about the history of the DFL party. One more thing I want to talk to you about, Peter, and we can briefly touch on this. You wrote a really interesting piece for MinnPost that I was reading last night, and it talks about the history of the DFL party. And I overall just, you had to have had a... had to have been really interesting on your part to talk to these different members of the DFL, especially former Vice President Walter Mondale, going through the history and talking about how, well, we got the F and the L in the DFL because it's It's kind of a checkered history with a lot of disputes and a lot of factions within factions among the farmers and the laborers in that party. Talk a little bit about writing that piece and speaking to some of the politicians to help you kind of craft what you were writing.
Right. So I'm not from Minnesota. I moved here 5 years ago from Washington State. And it was just sort of a given that there was this weird thing that Minnesota called its Democratic Party, the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. And it was just kind of accepted, and you'd ask about it, and you said, oh, they merged back a ways. And I read the histories of the state when I got here, so I had some idea what was going on. But it was always kind of in the back of my head, and one of the staff people for the state, DFL, mentioned that they were commemorating the 75th anniversary of that merger. So it gave me a news peg to kind of look back and do what I wanted to do anyway, which was to figure out what the point of this was. And then also to kind of look at the broader moving forward issue is there still a farmer element? And is there really a labor element beyond public employee unions in that union? And is it a misnomer kind of an issue? And really what I found, and I knew a little bit of this, what I found was this was never really a party representing agricultural interests and, you know, Cargill or whatever. It was always a populist. The Farmer Labor Party grew out of the Nonpartisan League and was always a populist movement in other states. In most other states, it was strictly a small farmer organization that objected to how they were being gouged by the railroads and the elevator companies and were trying to revolt against that and have some clout. In Washington State, it was the Grange, and other states, it was the Grange organization, which was similar. But in this state, because there was such a large industrial base, there was a feeling that they needed to partner with labor in the cities. And that grew out of, the Nonpartisan League in the 20s and 30s. And they had some success. They elected three governors of the state, the Farmer Labor Party did. But then fell on hard times, and you had this issue where the Republicans could win because the Farmer Labor Party would have a candidate and the Democrats would have a candidate. And, you know, they'd each get a quarter of the vote, and the Republicans would win the governorship. So the merger talk came out of that, and it was really pushed in specifically in 1944 by Franklin Roosevelt, who was concerned about losing the state because of this split, and we really wanted them put back together again.
Yeah, and even some of the divisions that existed back then between the D part of DFL and the FL part of DFL still kind of exist today, because you have the Democratic part that still represents the more, well, traditional Democratic positions versus the FL, farmer labor, which is the more kind of Bernie Sanders side of the party, the more progressive side of the party. And those divisions, as you talk about in your piece, still even exist today, or even going back to 2016, it was in a way almost similar to what we had back in the 1940s when the DFL actually merged into one party.
Yeah, and the other step that I think you alluded to in the introduction was the purge of the communist and communist-leaning members of the farmer labor wing of the party by Hubert Humphrey in 1948. And that kind of pushed the more radical element of the farmer labor party out of the Democratic, or Democratic Farmer Labor Party, and that is sort of the political element that is really back within the big tent of the Democratic Party across the country. And the people who've looked at it, historians and others, just have found that it's that same element and that same division within the party that still exists. So it really helps, I think you're right, to say farmer labor part of that coalition was never really a conservative rural agricultural interest party. It was always a populist element. And that, yeah, Bernie Sanders is more likely to be representing, or Elizabeth Warren, or, for that matter, Ilhan Omar. That part of the party is kind of what is the legacy of the farmer labor part of that coalition. And you still have more moderate Democrats who think that doesn't win elections statewide or nationally. So that dispute exists, but they're commemorating it this year, and some of the history is interesting, and I think it helps that people who are active in the party understand the difference, and Republicans who like to make fun of the lack of farm support by Democrats should at least understand what the origins were.
Oh, absolutely. And I highly recommend you go out and read that piece in Min Post by Peter Callahan talking about the history of the DFL. We won't have time to touch on it here, but there's so many other interesting aspects, how that farmer labor kind of part of the party was born out of North Dakota, which actually used to be a very populous state, or even talking about how there used to be progressive Republicans and how the Farmer Labor Party worked with former Governor Harold Stassen. A lot of really interesting things. I highly recommend you check out Peter's piece in Min Post talking about the history of the DFL and, of course, also the insulin fight as well. Hey, Peter, thanks so much for joining us on the program today. Lots of good stuff. Really appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Okay, thanks for inviting me on.
And that's all the time we have for today's program. Again, highly encourage you to check out the work of Peter Callahan over in Min Post, especially that piece he wrote about the history of the DFL party. Well, you hear the music, you know what that means. Our time is up for today, but we'll be back tomorrow for a live show. Thanks for listening.